Well, I won't repeat all that. But anyway, so I'm going to, but I am going to talk about surveys, and hopefully this will motivate things for the people who are going to talk about experiments coming up. And I'm going to do this in the context of a particular experiment. I'm going to talk about Overo and Bima, and sort of, you know, what our possibly one could describe as state of the art for distant cluster observations, and then and talk about the SEA, which is the follow-up to Overo, which is a follow-up and expansion of Overo and Bima. And so I'll talk about cluster searching and cluster observations in context of that one experiment. Okay, so Lloyd talked this morning generally about secondary anisotropies. I'm not going to say that much about it, except to say that that for you know, largely we're concerned with the exception of lensing, we're concerned about the fact that the universe. Although it was neutral, reionizes, and the CMB photons have to come through that, and things can happen to them along the way. And in particular, I'm going to talk about the Sunyer-Zadovich effect, which you'll see on the angular scales out on Arcman and angular scales is expected to be dominant for the secondary anisotropies. And this is a scattering of CMB photons by hot plasma bound to clusters of galaxies. And I'll talk a little bit about this more in a second. But just to put it in context, here's one of many plots which sort of show these expected secondary anisotropy contributions compared to the primary anisotropy, and you can see out here on arc minute scale, you know, it scales out about L of 3,000 or so out here at about a couple of arc minutes that that the SE is really the SE thermal effect is really dominating, so this is, you know, when we get down with this with the requisite sensitivity on these angular scales, this is what we expect to see. We expect to see the Sunyer-Zadovich effect from clusters of galaxies. All right. So for those of you who don't know, I'm sure everyone here is familiar, but the idea is that you have your cosmic microwave background. It's got to get to us. It's coming through some cluster of galaxies. And there's hot gas bound to these clusters of galaxies at about, 100 million degrees Kelvin. And as the CMB photons come through, some, you know, as many as 1%, 1 or 2% of them get scattered, and results in a spectral distortion of the CMB. And you can have this thermal effect where essentially you just have, as Lloyd described, this deviation from the blackbody spectrum of the CMB due to the fact that these electrons are very hot. And you can also have a bulk motion. Effect from the bulk motion. So the idea is there's essentially a Doppler effect on those scattered photons, and that can result in a second component that is essentially spectrally indistinguishable from a delta T fluctuation in the CMB, but is due to just these scattering from these from this gas, and happens to be, you know, linearly proportional to the Curie velocity or the bulk velocity of this of the cluster gas. So anyway, they produce these two distinct components of the SE effect. The first one, the SE thermal effect, here, you know, expanded for viewing is in black here we have an unperturbed black body spectrum, and this is just intensity as a function of frequency, and then I have essentially what happens to that black body spectrum after interacting with these hot electrons, and essentially what you're doing is you're just moving photons. Number of photons is conserved. You're essentially moving photons up from low energies to higher energies, and then of course for the kinetic effect, you can have either, depending if the cluster is moving towards you along a line of sight or away from you, you can that essentially Doppler shift on the scattered photons can result in either an increment or a decrement in intensity. And if you put these both on the same scale, you get this unique spectrum where, of course, down here below around 220 gigahertz, you get a decrement in intensity, and up above an increment, or a decrement or an increment at all frequencies for the kinetic or kinematic effect. So nice thing about this is these spectra are very distinct, they're unique, and they're independent of redshift, and these should be separable by measurements at millimeter wavelengths. If you were able to place a few millimeter wavelength bands in here at you know, say 100 to 200 gigahertz, you should be able to separate these two effects, which is of course very nice for those of us who are interested in determining just one of them at a time. All right, so SC measurements. Sarah showed some nice pictures yesterday of recent measurements with Susie of Sunyaev's Doge effect. Here I have, this is a map of made with the BIM array, which I'll talk a little bit more in the next talk. But this is these white contours here are essentially two sigma contours in temperature. And these are overlaid on top of the X-ray emission for a very hot massive cluster, ABEL-2163. And the intensity, or essentially the temperature decrement derived from that, or change in intensity, is plotted here down at 30 gigahertz for BIMA. And then this is a point from the Diabolo experiment on ERIM, and here are three SUSY points. And so the idea is that you know, the spectra is as expected and is being reliably measured. So why do we care about SC? What's interesting about it? And it can be used as a cosmological probe, certainly. We can look at the baryon fraction. I'll talk a little bit more about this in detail when I talk about OVRO. But the idea is that you can look at the SC and you can essentially weigh, you're just looking at the amount of gas in the cluster, so you can essentially look at all the baryons in the cluster by looking at the SC. And then you can get the total mass by looking at either gravitational lensing or the X-ray temperature, and that gives you a good measurement. You can look at the ratio of those two and get the baryon fraction. And then you can compare that baryon fraction with the baryon density from primordial nucleosynthesis, and you can get a measurement of the total mass density. And so that's a nice independent way of going about getting constraints on omega matter, and I'll talk a little bit more about that later. Also, clusters can be used as essentially standard rods, and you can have some additional probe of expansion and acceleration. And I should say this is not in preparation. This has now been accepted for publication. But Eric Gries has derived the Hubble constant from 18 measurements of clusters over redshift range from about 0.14 to 0.83. So this is fairly well established. I'll talk a little bit more about that later. And finally, of course, growth of structure. The growth of these clusters, we're going to go out and we're going to look and survey for these clusters. And the number of them that we find can place constraints on cosmological models. Now, you know, there are of course details to doing this, but the idea is that because the abundance of these clusters is so sensitive on cosmological parameters, we hope to have a reasonable chance of some success at this. One reason why this is very interesting is that it turns out that the SC effect is essentially the surface brightness is independent of redshift. So what I've got up here, these are measurements from OVRO and BIMA. I've got three clusters. I've got one at redshift 0.17, one at redshift 0.54, and one at redshift 0.83. And these are the SC decrements for those three clusters. And then down here in the insert, these are X-ray images all on the same scale as well for those three clusters. And what you can see is, essentially, the X-ray surface brightness redshifting away very rapidly, and the SC surface brightness essentially independent of redshift. And so the SC is this amazing, you know, it's essentially like, because the CMB was hotter back there and the fractional change in temperature is the same, it's like a source that gets hotter the further you put it away. And so it's very, you know, you end up with this constant surface brightness, which is very unique and allows us to look at clusters out to the redshift of formation. And so for lambda CDM or for open models, we expect that, you know, we should see clusters forming out at redshift of 2 or so. And if we're pick any region of sky and look, we should be able to see the clusters out there. So this is work that Martin White and others have done. And sorry if this is Astro PH, it's actually been published. This ViewGraph was called from something older. But the idea is that this is a hydrodynamical simulation of a square degree of sky. So in one square degree, you can see all this rich structure. The idea is, of course, you know, that when you look out along some particular column, you're looking through essentially the whole observable universe, and there are a lot of clusters along that line of sight. and that can lead to that can lead to considerable complications. But the idea is that that there's a lot of rich structure to look at. And so one thing we'd like to know is how well can we do at observing these clusters? So yeah, you know, you go back and you look and you say, yeah, there's a lot of clusters there, but for given experiment, how can you look at that? And so how well can you do at detecting those clusters? So one thing that several people have done is take these clusters, take simulated clusters of different masses, put them down, add CMB fluctuations, add noise, simulate observations of them, and attempt to recover, see how many of these clusters of given mass that you'd actually be able to detect. And playing this game, one for a given instrument, you can take a beam size for a telescope, and you can take a sensitivity level, and you can attempt to determine what sort of limiting mass you'd be able to achieve for a given experiment. And you say, well, essentially that's the most important thing is the mass, you know, how massive are the clusters. And of course there's details in terms of the formation history of the cluster and the morphology of the cluster in terms of how you detect it. And that's why, you know, you have to look at some actual realistic simulation of the cluster to be able to determine your efficiency for detecting them. But the real thing is you'd like to, you know, once you come up with a mass number like this, you can use your favorite description of structure formation to attempt to come up with some estimate of how many clusters you expect to see. And one thing I'll just note is that, of course, because these objects are fairly compact, that as you go down and you decrease your beam size down to about an arc minute, your mass limit for detecting these clusters decreases drastically. So for Akbar, where we're up at around 4.5 arc minutes, we're going to detect only the most massive clusters. And when you talk about an experiment like you'll hear later on for APEX or the South Pole Telescope, where you're going down to beam sizes approaching an arc minute, you can get down into quite interesting range where there are very high number of clusters. This is actually for the SEA survey, which I'm going to talk about in just a little bit. But this is essentially one representation of how many, or an estimate of how many clusters you'd expect to find per redshift interval for one square degree on the sky. And this is for three fiducial cosmological models. And here we have just a megamatter equals one. Open cosmology with a megamatter equals 0.3 and a lambda CDM, and you know right away you can see that there are fairly drastic differences in the cluster abundances as a function of redshift, and those things, you know, basically what you've got in here, you've got a volume redshift relationship, which depends on cosmology, of course. You've got abundance evolution, and you've got the actual structural evolution of the clusters, and that's all going in here. So you know, as everyone can probably guess already, that going from observations of clusters and going to cosmology involves all those things. And you really have to understand your clusters and cluster morphology well if you're going to play this game. And so, just as an aside, you know, you can say, well, what about gas evolution in the clusters? And you can say, well, using different models for the evolution of the gas in the clusters, you can see that you can get fairly significant changes in the number of clusters as a function of redshift, and you can see that what those can do for a reasonable range of models, you can see that that you can get fairly significant substructure, and this could affect detection of thresholds of these clusters. And this was just given to me by this is work by Daisuke Nagai at University of Chicago, and working on actually simulating some of the gas dynamics of these clusters to see what effect that would have on efficiency of detection. But anyway, it's without going into too much of the details, if you can handle that, if you can understand the cluster evolution, and you knew you essentially had these your detection efficiency well understood, then one could imagine that what you're left with is essentially the an evolution in this the number counts of clusters, right? So essentially, you have some evolution in the number counts. You also have some evolution in the volume of space, and these two things come in, and what you find is that for at low redshifts down here, you'll find that suppose you have some cosmological constant, and you say your equation of state for cosmological constant is described as W equals minus one. So we'll suppose it's not exactly W equals minus one, and you're trying to determine that difference. Down here at low redshift, where essentially the volume element is changing drastically because of that equation of state, that's going to be the dominant effect. And then out here at high redshift, essentially you've got subtle changes in this equation of state changing the growth of structure, and that'll change the abundance of clusters. And if you understood all these things in principle, you could untangle these, and you could place constraints on the equation of state. And this is not, this is not a trivial thing to do, and will require great understanding of cluster morphology to be able to do this. But it's something that it's a promising and has to be and really should be investigated. And here's some wildly, these are the kind of things you've probably seen flashed around, wildly optimistic constraints on equation of state that you can imagine. If you surveyed the whole sky with a 1.5 arc minute beam, got all the clusters, and then you went up and you were able to follow them up and get all the redshifts. What's that? Oh, sorry. Yeah, but it's essentially, it's 4,000, but it's all you'd get from say one hemisphere with good dust. But anyway, you look and you say, okay, this would require a concentrated optical program of likes of which we haven't seen to get photometric redshifts for all these. But what you could imagine doing is doing on order a tenth of this sort of sky coverage, and you can imagine in combination one could achieve these redshifts with weak lensing surveys. So you can imagine putting these together with weak lensing surveys and getting on order of a couple hundred square degrees, and that's what you'll hear about in the realistic surveys people talk about. But the point is, if in this wildly optimistic scenario, and not so wildly optimistic to the kind of things you were seeing for CMB several years ago, but what we thought was wildly optimistic. But the idea is in this sort of scenario where you could control the systematics, one could place, of course, very very tight constraints on a mega matter and interesting constraints on the equation of state as well, of the dark energy. All right, so there's several experiments producing images of node clusters. There's Bim and Ovro, which I'll talk about in a bit. Ryle, CBI, Suzy, Akbar, Diabolo. And but these experiments don't really have the sensitivity to search for significant numbers of unknown clusters. They can look at a known cluster and create an image, but they really can't go out and globally search for lots of new clusters. And so a new generation of experiments is under development. And there's interferometers like the ArcMinute, Microkelvin Imager, this SZA, which I'll talk about, Amoeba, and these have very high point source sensitivity, and they're ideal for producing detailed images. And there's also bolometer arrays like BoloCam, and you'll hear about APEX, SPT, and ACT, which is another project at Princeton. But these all involve large format bolometer arrays, and these are ideal for surveying large regions of the sky. And really, what you really want is the combination of these, because these interferometers will create very detailed high resolution images of clusters, which we'll want for exploring systematics and for understanding all these issues with morphology. And we'll also want these bolometer arrays for producing a very large number of counts and searching large regions of sky, which we want to do. So CBI, you saw some pictures of clusters, but it's actively measuring clusters. The Ryle telescope, which is 13-meter dishes, it's an east-west array, so it doesn't have very good UV coverage. It's produced images of decrements like this without really great fidelity, but But the idea is they're going to create this system called the ArcMinute microKelvin imager, where they're going to add an additional 10 3.5 meter dishes to that system. Now it's in Cambridge, so it operates from 15 gigahertz because the atmosphere is not so good. But anyway, this is actually, to my knowledge, funded and under construction. There's of course BoloCam, and it's a shame we don't have anyone here to talk about BoloCam. But BoloCam's 151 element Blomet array. I think they have about half that many elements actually operating right now, and they've been operating from the CSO. And this should be an ideal instrument for preliminary cluster searches. Okay, so that's all I want to say about. Hang on a second. Give me one second here. What's that? The vicuñas, yeah. Vicuñas. Yeah, so hang on a second here. yeah, it isn't it? Okay, good. Yeah. Okay, so here, let me talk about over on BIMA quickly. Okay, I'm sorry, my box got on here. slideshow, there we go. Oh man, hang on. There's a different, the problem is the two talks got put together and then I had the wrong one opened. But anyway, so I'm gonna talk about Overo and BIMA and the extension to SEA. So I won't go into the details, but this is a project started by John Carlstrom and Marshall Joy. And for the last several years, we've been making images of clusters. I got a few extra minutes though. John said so. So we've been using the OVRO telescope, which is six 10.4 meter dishes with a 2 gigahertz correlated bandwidth. BIMA is 10 6.3 meter dishes with 800 megahertz of correlated bandwidth. And the reason this is critical because the receivers all put out about 10 gigahertz of bandwidth. And it's really, we're limited by the correlators at the various observatories in terms of how much of the bandwidth we can correlate. And it's a serious impediment to our sensitivity when you look at, say, DAISY or CBI, which have 10 gigahertz of correlated bandwidth. So this limits really what we can do with Overo and BIMA. So these low noise receivers were installed first in 1994 and been producing high signal noise images at SE effect. And there's now about 60 of these, and I'll show some pictures of those in a second. But the idea is we pack the telescopes as close as we're allowed, and attempt to get the highest brightness sensitivity with the instrument. And actually, it would be nice to have some baselines that are a little shorter and build some smaller dishes, and that's what's going to happen with the SDA. All right, so here's an image. Here's a cluster. Once again, these are two sigma contours, 15 microKelvin, and here's the X-ray emission, ROSAT X-ray emission, ROSAT PSPC image of a cluster CLO16+16, which is a very massive cluster at redshift 0.55. And you can see that yes, in fact, the same gas that's creating the X-ray Bremsstrahlung radiation is resulting in the SE effect, although the scales are somewhat different. Here's a bit of a rogues gallery. This is just a few of the clusters, and we're going from here from a redshift of 0.14 to redshift 0.83, and we have a couple more at higher redshift as well. But there's 60 of these now, and so we've massed quite a nice sample. Basically, every cluster we hear about that's either optically or X-ray discovered at high redshift, we look at and see if we can detect it or not. so we have a very nice sample of these. I won't talk about this, but we can remove point sources very efficiently. So what can we do? Here's some. I'm going to go just talk about a couple of results. This is Laura Grego's thesis work, where she determined baryon fraction for each of 18 clusters, and came up with a 68% confidence upper limit of a mega matter of 0.4. And when you take into account the fact that some of the mass is actually in, not all the mass is gas, some of the mass is actually in galaxies, and do that, you get a value of about a mega matter of about 0.25. is what we come up with. And so it turns out it turns out to be quite complementary and quite consistent measurement of omega matter. So now this is Eric Ries's thesis work, where he determined essentially an angular distance diameter for 18 clusters that were imaged with nearly the same set of clusters that were imaged with Overo and Bimah, and he was able to determine a Hubble constant for these. And here's and he gets 60 plus or minus 4. That's the statistical error bar. Plus or minus 13 is a systematic error bar, and that systematic error bar is dominated by calibration issues. There's X-ray calibration, and which is a large fraction of this, and X-ray temperatures, which is a large fraction of this, and those are both going to improve significantly with AXF and XMM. So we expect that statistical error bar to come down drastically, and we may approach something more like this. Also, as we add more clusters, the statistics are going to get considerably better. You can see that changes as a function of cosmology, but not enough yet to be interesting with the redshift range we have. But one can imagine that if you're able to go out here to redshift 1, 1.5, and have several clusters, you could actually do the same kind of interesting test you would do with supernova, and you could do that out here. Now that, we'd like to do that. The problem is we just don't know of any clusters out here. We expect they're out there. Everything tells us they should be, but we just don't know about them. And if we can do a survey, that we could go out and actually gather a large sample of clusters out at the redshift 1 to 2 range, that would provide just what we need, just the probes that we need to test the universe's expansion in this way. So the other thing I want to talk about a little bit, because it got alluded to in the CBI results, and so I talk about with Overo and Bimah, in addition to looking at clusters, we also look at blank sky. And we've looked at several fields of blank sky. And in the last few years, we've looked at 10 independent fields that we selected particularly for low dust and low radio point source contamination. And we've imaged these down to a level of 10 to 20 microkelvin per 2 arc minute beam. And each of the fields is about 6 arc minute full width half max, the size of the Bimah primary beam. And so it all adds up to about a tenth of a square degree. So it's not a lot of sky. But we've got these fields, and we just finished a run this August where we've doubled our sky coverage. And so the results I'm going to show you here are out of date. The results that we have now are going to be we're going to have about twice the data what we've got in here, and our error bars on the plots of power are going to shrink by a factor of 2. So assuming that the level of power is the same, we don't know yet. So these are the CBI results shown on here, and here are the CBI results showing excess power out here in this green box, and then here, all the way out here at L of nearly 6,000 is where the Bimah measurements are. And it turns out that out here around L of 6,000, this is where this contribution from secondary SE anisotropies is peaking. And our detection is about 2.5 sigma out here, and appears to be robust. We've done a number of systematic checks. I can talk to anyone who has any interest in asking me about. But it appears to be a very solid result. And as I said, we've just doubled our sample. And so this point, if the power level stayed the same, this point's going to go to 3.5 sigma detection. If the power level stays the same, if it changes drastically, well. There you go. But we'll find out very soon. We'll have the data analyzed in the next couple of weeks. So, all right. To describe a little bit our method, we're very insensitive to point sources. Jonathan Sievers was talking about today was about the CBI and the effect of point sources on the fields. Our fields are so small that we actually at 4.8 gigahertz, it turns out the VLA primary beam is very well matched to our fields. So we've imaged every one of our fields with the VLA and gone down to roughly 20 to 25 microJansky RMS on every field. And being as our fields, actually the RMS in our fields is of order 150 microJanskys, these sources would have to have very perverse inverted spectra to be able to come into our and corrupt the BIMR measurements in any significant manner, and we don't see any additional sources or population of sources like that. And what's interesting is if we just take no point sources out of the BIMR data at all, right? Even though you can see there's some in there, we have every field has one or two point sources. If you don't do anything, we get an RMS of about 17, 18 microkelvin. Or actually, okay, working on it. But you get about 17 or 18 microkelvin. But if you take out all the 12 sigma sources, which are all the bright sources, you know, all the real booming sources that you know are in there, then you know it drops almost insignificantly. You take out all the 8 sigma sources, and drops a little bit more. And the fact of the matter is that the point sources, or goes up, but the point sources, it's noise. The point sources are actually completely insignificant to the analysis. And we remove the point sources by projecting them out in the same way that CBI does with their NVSS point sources. So essentially, we're completely insensitive to any source lying at the position where we've seen emission in the VLA fields. And we do that for all the sources. And we've run this threshold all the way down to like 4.5 sigma, where you're starting to take out lots and lots of sources. At that point, you start to lose degrees of freedom, and the noise goes up. But at this point, you can see insignificant loss of degrees of freedom, no effect from point sources. So I think our results are very robust. Just another look at it, where you have the CBI excess here. We actually have two bins. We have a second bin out here where we don't see a detection, but we have an upper limit. And so essentially, this is Komatsu's plot on the web. You can visit it there if you like. But anyway, the excess that we see and CBI sees are marginally consistent. And one can argue about whether they're consistent at 1 sigma or 1.5 sigma. But the point is they are consistent. We see an excess as well. We will have a strong constraint on sigma 8, whether we push sigma 8 as high as some have pushed it recently is yet to be seen. But together these results should place some very nice constraints.
Sigma 8 of 2.26.
Yeah, yeah. What would that look like? Okay. So anyway, so all right, one more minute here. Sorry. So now the point I actually promised to talk about is the SCA. Now that we've got that all motivated. So the idea is the SCA is going to add dishes to Overo and BIMR merging, and Overo and BIMR are going to come together and form the KARMA array, and they're going to go to a high site above Owens Valley. And continue doing millimeter wavelength work. But the idea is, in addition to that, they're going to be a subarray built of 10 3.5 meter dishes that are going to be added, and they're going to be outfitted with receivers for both 90 gigahertz and 30 gigahertz, and they're going to continue working on the SZ work. And this instrument is going to have incredible point source sensitivity. It's going to create very, very high resolution images of the SC, which are going to be, as I said, very essential for understanding these surveys. And I'll just tell you a little bit about the telescopes. In addition to these 3.5 meter telescopes, there's going to be a new correlator constructed, and that's for KARMA, and that's going to be built for the subarray as well. And this whole system is going to have 8 gigahertz of bandwidth, so it's going to be a full, in terms of SC observations, if you had an object that each was matched to the beam of this system in the same way that it was matched to the beam of the BIMA system, this system would be a full 10 times faster in observing temperature decrements. So this is going to be quite a powerful system, and it's coming online fast. This is funded, it's under construction, and it's going to be operational by the end of 2003. So the SCA will be going soon. Now, as I said, it's not the most powerful instrument one can imagine for cluster searching, and for the first season, we're really only talking about on order of 10 square degrees that it's going to observe. But in doing so, I'll show you some source counts, but it'll observe quite a large number of clusters. I'm not sure. This picture was given to me. That's what I was thinking. I was like, well, this is what happens if this is an important safety simulation. One thing I didn't state clearly is that I'm actually not a member of the SCA collaboration, and I'm giving this talk for Eric Leach, who wasn't able to make it. So if there are any mistakes, it's his fault.
So why did they change the name to John Carlstrom?
I know, especially when John was so annoyed by it, it seemed like so much fun. But anyway. This is the evidence that things are actually being built. This is one of the plates for the dish. This is just to indicate how this is sort of the UV coverage we get with a fairly sparse overall array. This is what just the SCA would do, and this is of course what SCA and KARMA would do combined. And the idea is that you have both range of long and short baselines, really, really dense coverage all the way down.
Sort of
8 gigahertz, right? And that's part of the reason what you're seeing here is this fattening out. What you've done is you've taken these lines and made 8 of them, essentially, right? So it's going to be 8 gigahertz of correlated bandwidth. So it's going to be a full 10 times faster than what we're getting with BIMA. All right. So anyway, so yields from the SCA survey, the idea is that here, so we're going to be able to, as I said before, we get clusters out here to redshift of 2 or so, and we get, tens of clusters per square degree, that sort of order, and here's the total clusters we get in this of order 12 degree survey, and you can see once again, just the dependence on cosmology, and you can contrast that finally here with an X-ray survey, which of course detects a large number of clusters, but at relatively shallow redshifts. So anyway, let me try and finish up here. So the expected cosmological constraints with the SCA are interesting. We can place some nice constraints on omega matter, omega lambda, we expect, and actually determine and make a fairly nice determination of sigma 8. And then you say, well, what about W? Unlikely. If you look and you say, well, what about W? And it's like the expected error bars on W are going to be are not going to be of precision to make it a terribly interesting measurement. So SCA will not place strong constraints on the equation of state of the dark energy. But what it will do is it'll create if there are clusters, especially a subsample of serendipitously discovered clusters that we want to image in detail, the SCA will really be ideal for that. Okay, I'm done. Okay. Anyway. All right. Any questions? Yeah.
Can we go back to this business of W and the cosmology?
Oh, I wish we wouldn't, but okay.
Well,
okay. Okay.
So
I'm going back.
Yeah.
Which one? Which one do you like?
Somewhere.
You like that one? Okay.
So you said quite simply that the effect of cluster formation is going to be around redshift 2.
Yeah.
And so between redshift 2 and redshift 1, some interesting things are going to be happening. The clusters you see at redshift 1 to 2 are not going to be the same as the clusters
absolutely
from 1 to 0. And you've covered that over with saying we're going to learn about what clusters are. But it seems to me you're going to have to learn about what clusters are and how they change to quite thoroughly before you'll actually be able to use
absolutely
the observations of the very
absolutely absolutely
cosmological
program. Absolutely.
It's clear that all of that stuff has to be done kind of silently.
No, I wasn't trying to sweep that over.
The other way, really. I think what we really find out is how clusters evolve in the earlier.
Well, that's right. And one could.
This is a good way to find those types of changes.
No, that's right.
Very important. And in question,
No, that's right. And you know, the point is, and part of the reason for motivating this in terms of number of clusters is not just to say, you know, this is the sensitivity of the cosmology on the number of clusters. This is actually to say, this is how many test probes we'll have to study just these interesting questions you're talking about. So, yeah.
There's a lot of random disagreement amongst experimentalists. You showed this fascinating new unpublished measurement in RIL 7000 of the CME power spectrum, the low relative to CDI.
Is it not unpublished? It's Dawson et al. It's been accepted for AppJ. It's on AstroPH.
Well, unknown to Max is what.
Okay.
Not
okay.
Max
is talking about it. So you posit it more on how you reconcile all this.
I don't think we have to reconcile it. If you look out here, I think they're consistent actually.
Those are one signature.
Right.
So let's go look. Well, there's harmony in this room, in it, maybe. So basically, what we have is that this is the result here that I showed with just one of these together. This is those are the two bins combined. Okay, so we can take our L bin resolution, and we can take our visibilities and bin them into two different L bins, or just use one L bin, and assume there's a flat band power. In just one L bin or in the two separate bins, and this point is for assuming all the visibilities are essentially described by one flat band power, and this is when we split it into two, and we saw that we did detect significant excess power in the shorter baseline bin, but then larger baseline bin we didn't. We can talk about, but the larger baseline bin in this is not nearly as significant because the noise is much higher, because it's longer baselines, the brightness sensitivity isn't as good. Noise is much higher. I haven't compared in detail with CBI to say, you know, are they significant at you know, what is the confidence that they describe the same model? I haven't thought about it in detail, but it's marginally consistent.
Our detection is 2 point some sigma.
So they're 2.5. They're 3 sigma. We're 2.5. I mean, how different can they be? You know? Yeah.
So it's one thing was for the non-Gaussian 68% confidence region, and we were 95%. Or in other words, 3.1 sigma of the CBI close. What is that in terms of the confidence region?
Well, if you go back with eGraph, you can see what the 95% confidence is. That's that box.
But you've included quadrivariant error bars, there's a really smaller error bar if you just wind up the limit.
Huh?
Technical detection, so some whether if they want to put it on the plot and say what it is and compare it with what other experiments they've done, then they're not right.
Well, I think the thing is, in the next couple of weeks with the new sample we have, I should say that also that our error bars here have about equivalent contribution due to cosmic variance. I mean, this is a fairly small region of sky, and that'll drop as well with our increased sky coverage. So we're going to do considerably better on this point, and then you know at that point we can ask again whether we're still consistent with CBI. I think right now I would have to say we are. And without being quantitative about it, but yeah.
Yeah, I think it's clear that it's consistent, but I'm still curious, is this 95% confidence level, is that derived assuming the underlying thing is a Gaussian field, or is there effect?
I think if we've got the offset on the normals.
Okay, what about the underlying
phone line? Yeah, it's assuming a Gaussian line.
Okay.
The commodity stuff shows the variance of Gaussian.
So I'm not sure I understand your question, Mike.
Well, so what error bars you derive, right, depends on what you assume the statistics are in the field.
That's right.
And so this is for assuming it's a Gaussian underlying.
That's right. That's right. And so that's our error bars are an underestimate for that reason. Yes, absolutely. In the paper, we give a one line about what we expect the size of that effect to be, but we have not done a very detailed treatment of it. Okay. All right, sorry about that, Daniels, man.
That's right.
So that's what you've been asking for all afternoon, the picture of the cocoonia. Cocoonia.
Not lots of dollars for zebras, but...
And it's not the cocoonia. All right, good afternoon. My name is Nils Halvorsen. I'm currently a postdoc at the University of California at Berkeley. And this afternoon I'm going to talk to you about an instrument that we at the University of California are building in collaboration with a group from the Max Planck Institute for Radio Astronomy in Bonn, Germany. The instrument we are building is a 300-element bolometer array receiver at 2 millimeter wavelength initially, and that is designed to do a large survey of galaxy clusters using the Sonnier-Zeldovich effect. With the survey, we anticipate discovering on the order of 1,000 or so previously unknown clusters, and that will enable us to, as has been mentioned numerous times earlier today, study in detail the evolution of structural formation in the universe, and as long as, with some caveats that we've also discussed earlier, constrain cosmological parameters that are associated with structure formation, such as the mass density of the universe and the dark energy equation of state. The receiver is going to be mounted on the APEX telescope. That is a 12-meter submillimeter telescope that's pictured in a cartoon here. It is funded and under construction by the Max Planck Institute for Radio Astronomy, UNSLA in Sweden, and the European Southern Observatory. And it will be deployed to the a site in the Atacama Plateau in Chile, in seeing first light in mid-2003, operational by the end of 2003. The APEX SC instrument, which is currently under development at Berkeley, we'll see first light on the telescope in early 2004. So as I mentioned earlier, this is a collaboration between Berkeley and the Max Planck Institute for Radio Astronomy in Germany. Adrian Lee is the PI of the instrument at Berkeley, and Carl Menton is the director of submillimeter and millimeter wavelength radio astronomy at the Max Planck Institute. So as I mentioned earlier, I think the primary science goal of the instrument, as was mentioned just a few minutes ago, the really exciting stuff is that we're going to discover and catalog, you know, thousands of clusters that are previously unknown at all redshifts or in a mass-limited survey, and with sensitivity that's independent of redshift. So we're going to see clusters at higher redshifts than have previously been discovered. And so you're going to have this catalog, and you can do all sorts of things. You can observe the evolution of clusters, the evolution of structure, and test theories of, for instance, the Press-Schechter theory of structure formation. And in a more optimistic, we're also going to be able to constrain the mass density very well, and mass density that's independent, that's has very different systematic effects than mass density constraints from CMB targeted SC surveys measuring mass fraction, et cetera. And in addition, we hope to place some constraints on the dark energy equation of state. We'll also be able to do much more with this catalog. We'll be able to do much more and extensive constraints on the Hubble constant, H naught, and the acceleration parameter, Q naught, along with X-ray follow-up on observed clusters. And finally, secondary science we're going to do is study CMB secondary anisotropies like weak lensing and the Ostracker-Vishniak effect. All right, you've seen both of these view graphs earlier today, so this is, I guess this is some stress on the importance of these view graphs, or this is for all of you who are asleep during both Bill's talk and Lloyd's talk this morning. I noticed that Lloyd showed this the same view graph on three successive slides. So this is if there's one thing you take away from today. So just a brief review of the Sunyaev-Zaldovich effect. The SC effect is the inverse Compton scattering of CMB photons as they pass through the hot electrons, which are captured in the potential well of a cluster. The thermal black body power spectrum of the CMB photons, about 1% of those photons are scattered to higher energies, and the consequently, there's a distortion in the black body spectrum. The total number count of the photons is preserved. On the right here, this shows the differential intensity from that of a nominal black body as a function of frequency. So at low frequencies, below about 220 gigahertz, you're going to see a decrement in the surface brightness. So, and above 220 gigahertz, you're going to see an increment. So for instruments which observe in these frequencies down here, an SC cluster is going to look like a cold spot against the background CMB light. Okay, thanks. All right, this Bill also showed you this earlier, but the SC effect is actually a wonderful and unique tool for discovering galaxy clusters. And the reason for that is that it's the surface brightness is independent of redshift, as Bill told you earlier. So that's one aspect that makes it unique. The other aspect is that the galaxy cluster, the angular diameter of a galaxy cluster, i.e. about, let's say, a megaparsec yardstick, does not decrease, the angular diameter does not decrease monotonically with redshift because we live in this stretching universe. In fact, it reaches, for any redshift, this yardstick has a minimum angular diameter of approximately an arc minute. So that the actual angular diameter of the cluster is observable at all redshifts. So this view graph shows three clusters observed in the SC by Carlstrom et al. Using the OVRO and BIMA arrays. This is low redshift, medium redshift, and higher redshift of 0.83. And qualitatively, at least, you can see that the intensity of the SC effect does not change with redshift, whereas the insets, which are the X-ray brightness, are fainter at higher redshifts. So this the SC is therefore a really unique tool for being able to discover clusters at high redshifts. Okay, Bill just showed you this, so I'll just be really brief here. But this is, instead of showing you DNDZ, that is a change in number of clusters with redshift, this is just showing the cumulative number greater than Z. And you can see, at least qualitatively, that there are very different number counts for different cosmologies. This is open CDM, lambda CDM, and the tau CDM. This is with omega matter equal to 1. So to first order, at least you can see that there's a lot of cosmology that you can do with cluster survey. This is, again, with some caveats, which I'll discuss later, a constraint in the omega matter dark energy equation of state plane. For a 100 degree square degree SC survey, the red dashed line indicates the constraint if you determine sigma 8 from the low Z clusters that you discover. And this very optimistic red line is if you have already constrained sigma 8 well with other methods. All this assumes, of course, that you know very well what the relationship between the Y distortion and the and mass is, and other things that we discussed earlier. So it's I think it's very optimistic at this point. But at the very least, we're going to be able to test, we're going to be able to look at the evolution of clusters and cluster physics. All right, now I want to talk to you more specifically about the APEX SC instrument and tell you a little more about the instrument. It's a 300 element bolometer array, as I told you earlier. We're going to implement it with single color array at 2 millimeter wavelengths and 1.4 millimeter wavelengths. We're going to have a swappable horn array and filter. The instrument, I'm going to talk about the optics in a bit, but it's going to have a 0.4 degree field of view. We're going to survey 250 square degrees to 10 microkelvin, and in a couple seasons worth of data. We're drift scanning. Martin, I thought I had 20 minutes. we're drift scanning, and we're doing this to avoid a differential ground pickup. And I'm going to talk about these other things in a second here, so I'll move on because Martin's urging me along. The APEX telescope, as I told you before, is a 12-meter on-axis ALMA prototype. It's a submillimeter dish, so it's going to be used as an observatory class instrument for submillimeter astronomy, as well as the millimeter wavelength SC survey instrument. Let me talk a little bit about optimal, the horn diameter, which would be optimal for mapping speed in a horn-coupled array. This is just a function of, this is just showing the aperture efficiency for a single horn as a function of horn diameter in units of F lambda. Alternatively, you can think of this as units of lambda over D, which is the size of the airy disk on the, of a diffraction spot on the focal plane. And the aperture efficiency at for small horn diameters is small because you have a lot of spillover off the edges of the primary or onto your Leo stop. And it's also small at large horn diameters because you are under-illuminating the primary and not using the primary efficiently. So your optimal coupling to a point source lies somewhere around 2F lambda. But your mapping speed is proportional to this aperture efficiency squared, the number of elements you have, and it's inversely proportional to the photon power for a and for a photon loading limited bolometer array. So let me just show you quickly a few results for optimal the optimal horn size. This is the to optimize your mapping speed. This is showing the relative mapping speed as a function of the horn diameter again. And let's just, this is for three different scenarios, but let's focus on a scenario where your source temperature, including the sky, is about 12 Kelvin, and this and your Leo stop, which I'll talk about more in a second, is has a temperature of 3 Kelvin inside your Dewar. Then your optimal horn diameter here, it shown by the cyan line, is approximately 1F lambda, 1F lambda in diameter. So it's the if you're delimited by your field of view and not by the number of elements in your horn array, it favors horns that are quite small. On the other hand, if you're in our position where we really only want to implement a 300 element array, then you're limited. We're going to say now that the number of horns is fixed, and we want to figure out what the optimal horn diameter is given that. And in this scenario, under the same sky and Leo's top temperature conditions, then the optimal horn diameter moves up to about 2F lambda. Okay. It turns out that our array is quite well coupled to the field of view of the APEX telescope. We can fit 300 elements just into the maximum field of view of the APEX telescope. So we're in a situation where we're just in an end-fixed situation, but it's very well coupled to the field of view. So it turns out to be an ideal situation. We could improve our speed by moving to an array of, let's say, a 1,000-element array of 1F lambda horns in the future. But for now, 300-element array of 2F lambda horns is quite good. Okay, I don't have time to talk about the optics, but I just want to convey to you that that the optics for a wide field of view instrument is challenging. It's a wide field of view, half a degree. Since we're limited by our monolithic array construction to a 15-centimeter diameter array, this limits the focal ratio at the array to being less than being quite fast, less than F number of 1.75. So there tend to be you have to design the optics well in order to avoid being limited by aberrations. Bottom line is that we have a couple straw man designs that we've tackled this problem, and we're honing straw man designs that have achieved diffraction limited optics over the half degree field of view. This is showing progress on the TES bolometer arrays. Since 1996 in Berkeley, single element TES bolometer or transition edge sensor bolometer arrays have been demonstrated at Berkeley. The noise properties are well behaved and well understood. This is a mask design for a 300 element array that we're planning on fabricating in six triangular wedge-shaped sections. There's plenty of room between the individual spiderweb elements for the thermistor wiring. All right, the SQUID readout electronics, and I'm not going to go into detail, but because our bolometers are voltage biased, we need a low impedance readout to read the current signal. And this shunt feedback SQUID amplifier allows this low impedance, since the impedance here is given by the parallel impedance of the input inductance coil of the SQUID and the active impedance here, the active impedance of the feedback resistor, which is actually the actual feedback resistance divided by the open loop gain of the amplifier. We're planning on AC biasing at a couple of 100 gigahertz, well above microphonic frequencies a couple hundred kilohertz. I'm a gigahertz man, which is well above the microphonics frequencies of the Dur. All right. Martin's spanking me hard here. Okay. This is my second to last slide. Give it to me, baby. All right. This slide is courtesy of Martin White. This is the can of worms slide, and we have a lot that we still need to understand and challenges that we still need to face before being able to do precision cosmology with an SC survey. First of all, there's source confusion from the CMB itself, from point sources, and from both filamentary and other SC multiple SC clusters in the line of sight. There's a problem with completeness that we need to think about. And also the Y distortion, the relationship between the Y distortion, in other words, the change in intensity of the SC effect as a function of mass is not understood to the precision that you would need to do precision cosmology. And also, we really need to think about how we're going to get redshift information for the clusters in follow-up work. And that is going to be a real challenge, because getting redshifts for thousands of clusters is not easy, so we need to think hard about how to do that. So those are some challenges that the community is going to have to face. Finally, just to give you an idea of the project status, the telescope is funded and under construction. The APEX SC receiver is funded and it's under development. We've gotten some diffraction limited designs for the tertiary optics. We're currently doing cryogenic testing of the pulse tube cooler and testing microphonics effects. Let's see, I forgot to mention earlier, but we're trying to use implement a receiver that has no liquid cryogens. And it will be really nice if we're able to do that. And finally, we're also testing the TS bolometer, fabricating TS bolometers that are optimized for performance on the ground-based APEX instrument. And squid readout prototype is being built and tested as we speak. So that's all I have to say.
Turn 300 kilometer measurements into a map?
That's a very good question. He said you must have a data analysis plan. How do you turn a 300 element bolometer array measurements into a map? And the answer is that that our plan making is still in progress on that. So I think the data analysis is certainly not going to be trivial, but we're planning on developing a pipeline to do that. Yeah.
One thing is we hope to take advantage of the large effort in the theoretical community on analyzing the data. Cost data analysis and map data analysis. So it seems like people are developing the tools to tackle these
data.
These things merge as we start to apply the data.
Yeah.
Where'd all this go? Oh no. They deleted all our
maybe in the shared files or no.
There we go. Whoever did that should be spanked.
There's no person.
All right, so I've got a lot of slides in common with Bill and...
Explain
the SC effect? No, I'm not going to. So anyway, I'm going to try and go fast here so we can leave more room for Steve Meyer, because this is going to bear a lot of similarity to the previous two talks. I'm going to speak about a new project called the South Pole Telescope involving... this cast of characters right here. I'm happy to say that as of last week, we just found out that we were approved by the National Science Board, and Office of Polar Programs is right now getting the funding to us, so that's really great. So this project is actually going ahead now. It's not a virtual thing anymore. And we're also getting crucial funding to help out from the Center for Cosmological Physics in Chicago. So so we're starting to move. The science objectives, which I'm going to talk about, are going to be quick. One of them is going to be counting SD clusters, so you've heard about that. So really what I'm just going to say is sort of describe the capabilities of the South Pole Telescope and the first array that we're planning on putting in there. So we're using, of course, going to try and constrain cosmological parameters and functions, right? So Max should wake up in the back there. In the future, now we're pushing right now to, what was that? Well, it was, right now we're going after this cluster cosmology very strongly, and we're thinking, of course, about future ideas for receivers that are as yet unfunded. Some of the ones that You know, I'm very interested in our mapping, getting more frequency coverage than we need for the cluster cosmology to go at these CMBN isotropies at very small angular scales, that kind of stuff, very strongly, and also to do polarization measurements in the microwave background. So I'll show some slides on that, but that's actually sort of beyond the current project scope. But once you get a telescope down there, hopefully we'll be using it for all we can in the future. So a basic outline, I'll say more about this, is that the telescope, we're going to be using it for cosmology somewhere between 1 and 3 millimeters. It's actually good to much shorter wavelengths than that, or will be good once it's built. It's got an 8-meter diameter primary with some guard rings on it so that we can, so it actually acts like a bigger dish actually for the cosmology measurements. So our resolution should be better than, or equal to or better than 1.3 arc minutes. We're going to optimize that as we finish off the details of the design now that we're really going ahead. And it's also optimized for a very large field of view. Okay, it's an offset telescope. I'll show you pictures of the optics and that kind of thing. But again, we're trying to fit in as much useful field of view as we can so that we can use extremely large bolometer arrays. The South Pole site is, I'm not going to go into this too much, but it is a really great site. It's got very low water vapor, so it's a wonderful place to do these kinds of observations. The geography is really great if you want to look at fields for and integrate really deeply on fields. For instance, DAISY has observed the CMB polarization towards two fully fields for about 200 continuous days last winter. So if you really want to stare at something, it's a great place. And also, it's a great place to do business because there's all this sort of support in place.
After all that staring.
It's also a gentle environment, it turns out. This is actually really interesting because when you go to design a telescope of this size, there are many factors they have to take into account that are really worrisome. One of the big important ones is what are the high wind speeds that this thing's going to have to endure. And the South Pole has the highest recorded wind speed of any U.S. Weather Service station. So it's actually a great place from wind. It also doesn't get a lot of snow. It's a desert. It doesn't get any rain. Okay, the last time it rained there was a couple hundred million years ago. And so the only interesting engineering you have to do is for the cold, which is something that you can handle. Okay, so it's something that you can do, and you don't have to worry about all this other nasty stuff. So here's a picture of the optics again. This is the 8-meter primary, photons coming in, bouncing off a bunch of free imaging optics. And as Neil said, it's hard to get all that field of view, but we're working on it. We've actually got a design that does it, and we're optimizing that. It's an off-axis of Gregorian, so we can get that wide field with no blockage, so we don't have to worry as much about side lobes and that kind of thing. We do have a chopping flat in there so that we can do sort of standard, Akbar-like observations, but we're also planning on being able to scan the whole telescope to do those kinds of observations. Here's a sort of cartoon of the thing. There's a building actually down at the South Pole that already exists called the Dark Sector Lab. It's sitting there, and we're gonna move in. This picture is a little bit old. You have to lower the whole thing by a floor, but that's a detail you probably don't care about. This is a picture of the telescope with the receiver cab out here. All the drive components kept warm and accessible so that they don't have to be... That's basically how you do the cold engineering. You make sure as little as possible actually gets cold. If you take that telescope now, the one thing that we want to do that's not shown in that cartoon is put a big shield around it. So we're planning on having an enormous shield, sort of like is around Viper and Akbar here, or around DAISY here to help out with the ground pickup and that kind of thing. So this is going to be a big, large telescope, but it's going to have all the protection that we're used to do these CMB-type observations. The first array that's going to be put on here is, I think you may have already seen this picture, being engineered up at UC Berkeley. It's a transition edge sensor array with 1,000 elements. So we have exponents now in our numbers of bolometers in an array. The idea is to actually use a horn-fed array here, so it's sort of easier to deal with than bare arrays. And we have to note here that, of course, reading out 1,000 channels isn't very easy, so there's a little bit of engineering there that's got to have some work done on it. And that's also being done right now up at UC Berkeley. And this is just a cartoon to show some of the SQUID readout and all that kind of stuff that they're working on. And they've actually done some prototyping already and some testing on that kind of stuff. So it's coming along, which is good. OK, so now I'm just going to go and describe the science. What's that? You like the acronyms? Is that what it is? OK. Anyway, so this is what we want to do. I'm again not going to, oh, I see. Yeah, that's what you like. All right, so this is what we want to do. We want to count clusters, so I'll talk to you a little bit about that. we're going to constrain functions, and we're going to talk about that. Anyway, the details of the survey are that, look, if you get a big telescope like this with an 8-meter aperture and a 1.3 arc minute beam and 1,000 bolometers on there operating, you know, down near, you know, the sensitivities that we can get them operating given the good atmosphere there, the idea is that, in fact, if you go through the sensitivity numbers and you even have about 50% operating efficiency, you can do of order of 4,000 square degrees sky, 4,000 square degrees of sky to about delta TCMB of 10 microkelvin per arc minute or per pixel, something like that, in one season. So the sensitivity that Bill was talking about, oh my gosh, that's wild and crazy, we're wild and crazy, all right? So this is the goal. Okay, now there's a long ways to get there, but that is certainly something that you can write down on paper. It's not absolutely crazy. This gets us, this kind of sensitivity here, as Bill showed you in the table, gets you down to cluster masses of something like 4 times 10 to the 14th or so, maybe a little bit better. And given this kind of survey, you expect tens of thousands of clusters. Okay, so we're going to start building up databases with just enormous numbers of clusters. And this is the power of this thing compared to the SZA, right? The SZA is built to go deep on individual, smaller numbers of clusters and really look at them in detail, right? This thing is a cluster detector and seeing just huge numbers of them, but not with as much resolution or in as much detail. You already saw that. This, you're already seeing plots like this. These are plots for the SPT, and the point here is number greater than Z. There's a couple of interesting things to note here. You know, we're up near 10 to the 4 for, you know, the number that's at any redshift, right? And if you look here, you can say, okay, how many above redshift of 1? You know, it's border 1,000 or more, right? So the neat thing about this is that if you actually go and get redshifts for all these things so that you know what redshift all these clusters are at, you can start constraining functions, Max. Okay, you can start going and you start making mass histograms as a function of redshift. Test the press sector, function, and test, you know, whether simulations are actually giving the right mass histograms, that kind of thing. Okay, so I think that'll be really fun. Okay, you can go back to your laptop. What's that? The redshifts. Okay, great. The redshifts are a big problem. Okay, so in fact, if you want to constrain dark, I think my next slide is the redshifts one. But the point is that it's really hard. Okay, and we would love to have people with big telescopes talk to us in big arrays. Okay, really, you go after them with photometric redshifts, and really, this may not be the survey that we actually end up doing, right? The 4,000 degree survey, because if we can't get the redshifts, we'll probably choose to go deeper on a smaller amount of sky, and get as much redshift overlap as we can, right? So that would lead to lower mass limits, right? Okay, so. Again, systematic things aside, this is just statistical power on this kind of thing. Constraints in terms of W and the omega in this dark energy component, and these fantastic limits that you can get with these numbers of clusters. But of course, there's lots of questions here about cluster evolution and all sorts of other things that you have to worry about. But I won't go into those. This is the motivation slide, as Bill already put this up, but I'll just call this the motivation slide for getting redshifts, because if we don't have redshifts, we don't do nearly as well on all this kind of stuff, whereas if we do have redshifts, of course, we learn a lot more about the clusters, the cluster evolution, if you want to look at it that way, and we learn a lot more about cosmology if we do end up being able to turn it around, which I certainly hope we can. That's the goal, at least. Okay, so I'm going to move on and stop talking about cluster cosmology, since we've been talking about clusters in the previous few slides, and just also point out that there's an awful lot of potential here for doing other things, doing the small-scale CMB stuff and also CMB polarization, and there's some really neat stuff that you can do here. In terms of statistical power, well, okay, Bill already showed that slide, so I won't dwell on it for very long. There we go. This is a slide that is meant just to convey the statistical power that you can bring to bear on questions like this, using an instrument like this with 1,000 detectors, either at 150 gigahertz or at 217 gigahertz in a full observing season, given some observing efficiency. Up here is just to say, okay, at 150 gigahertz, here's an SZ power spectrum, sort of a random one that I'd sort of fit out of something out of the literature. and just the, you know, the error bars that you could actually get on that power spectrum. Okay, so it's ridiculous, right? You can if you can really just go in and bang away and say that what you're seeing is thermal SZ, you're going to do it really well, right? So these questions, like for instance, the CBI excess, the point is that at least by the time we bring instruments of this caliber, you know, online, those questions are going to go away. We're going to know
so
what's there.
Do your observations agree with the CBI and?
Well, I don't. This is only one sigma. Okay. Of course, in order to get at any of these other things that are not thermal SZ, to get at the OV or the KS/KSZ, you know, same thing, right? If we want to get at those questions, we need spectral coverage, right? Because you're going to have to subtract out this stuff. So you could say, okay, what if I can design my 217 gigahertz channel such that it doesn't even see the relativistic effect, you know, all that kind of stuff, right? Then this is the statistical power we would bring to bear. Again, I haven't done any fancy frequency subtraction, so you should really take this with a big grain of salt. But the point is that we really can, either by going on a large patch or concentrating on smaller patches and digging down deeper, you can start at least to bring the statistical power to bear and try and get at these questions. But that requires, you know, that's more receivers, more development. Although I should say we do plan on observing with that first array, both at 150 gigahertz and at higher frequencies by switching filters. These are great simulations by Wayne Hu of projected mass and reconstructing that projected mass using the higher order correlations. Again, you have to be able to get rid of the thermal SZ stuff in order to do this. If you do it with just temperature, you end up getting a lot of noise on the small angular scales. If you bring in polarization to bear on this problem as well, so a polarization-sensitive receiver, then you can do a much better job of reconstructing the projected mass between you and last scattering. So, and again, this is an ambitious 100 square degrees at really good low errors. But actually, again, if you make the numbers for the kinds of instruments that we think we can build in a few years, those are not absolutely crazy. I'm done. All right. Thank you.
Any questions?
Yes. What about the dusty galaxies? Have you thought about what you can actually do?
People have thought about what we can do. That's not really in what we're planning on right now in the first generation of instruments. But the dish is being designed to go to shorter wavelengths and all that kind of stuff. So it's you're talking about submillimeter observations, is that? Yeah. So
correlations. Be there.
Yeah. Well, we have not done a lot of simulations on that. Tony Stark, when they were originally talking about a 10 meter at the pole, did do some simulations with dusty galaxies. But I thought that was at shorter wavelengths. So isn't that right? Yeah, I mean, so the dish will be capable of going to shorter wavelengths, and that's, you know, sort of in the long-term projected, hey, let's do that, but it's, you know, it's not in the current plan, sort of what we're being funded for right now. Yeah. Yes?
So you're going to be able to keep the pesky millimeter types who want to do spectroscopy off the telescope? Or?
At least for the duration of our getting through this first thing, our plan, you know, we have a plan. This is now not a facility. It is an experiment which could someday turn into that, right? But we're obviously not funded to make it a user facility and have other people come and put their receivers on, right?
Tony Stark must want to put it
on. Oh, sure. No, absolutely. Absolutely. So the telescope will be capable of that. It will be sitting there. It would be stupid to turn it off after a year or two of observations, right? It's obviously something that would be wonderful to use. But, of course, those will all have to go through peer review and funding, and the telescope will have to have money to operate and that kind of thing. Any other questions? All right. No. All right. Thanks. Let's have Steve next. So you can find. I think you're in that folder. There you go.
So I'm going to talk about an experiment that is an attempt to use a new observable, namely the fluctuations in the cosmic infrared background. And this is an observable that we hope will be useful for determining things about the formation of galaxy and the growth of structure into the more intermediate redshift range. This is a collaboration between Chicago, Goddard Space Flight Center, Wisconsin, Massachusetts, and UC Davis. It has an acronym, which I can't ever remember, but I wrote it down just to make sure everybody saw it. The question is, what happens at the end of the Dark Ages? And the questions that come up are, when does galaxy formation start? How does the rate of star formation change with cosmic time? And how is galaxy formation dependent on the large-scale environment? And these are questions that we cannot by ourselves answer with this experiment, but it is things that we can begin to approach and together with other measurements get a handle on. The thing I want to say is that the cosmic infrared background fluctuations are considerably less well studied than the fluctuations in the microwave background, theoretically. And observationally, it's unstudied completely because it's not yet detected. So we're in a much more of a state of flux than any of the things that you've seen in the past. And you'll see that in what I have to say. So the goals of this measurement are to detect and characterize the fluctuation power spectrum of the infrared background at angular scales from 5 minutes to about 10 degrees. And what will come of this is a measure of the galaxy-weighted mass power spectrum between a redshift of 5 and maybe as far as 5, depending on how bright galaxies are. There is the possibility of dividing these fluctuations into redshift bins. And it gives us information over a very large range of scales that ranges from the very much linear scales all the way into the nonlinear scales. In addition, it is a probe of the galaxy luminosity function, one number in the galaxy luminosity function at high redshift. So how does this work? Let me tell you a little bit about the source itself. So here's a plot of backgrounds in general, cosmic background, cosmic microwave background, and the infrared background lies here. The infrared background brightness is actually quite high, but it's the last of these backgrounds to have been discovered, being discovered only about 5 years ago. And the problem is that infrared backgrounds are tough to see if they're uniform, because typical observations always chop one thing against another. And in fact, to find this background, FIRAS was used by two separate groups. This is the Fixon et al. Paper, where the assumption was that the sky, which is a function of position and frequency, is made up of a uniform spectrum plus a spatial part and a spectral part, which are separable. That's the model. So if you take all of the pixels in the FIRAS sky and make a spectrum of the brightest 10% and the next 10%, you can see that there is a spectral part which is constant, and then there's a spatial part which just decreases. If you set the spatial part equal to zero, then you get a spectrum of what's left over. And here is then the separation. Here's the cosmic microwave. This is the total spectrum of all the FIRAS pixels averaged into this way. This is the separation into the CMB, the dipole, the ZODI emission, and then these bins of 10% each for the background. And what you can see is that it doesn't go down to zero as you go to the dimmest pixel. So there's some uniform element. Now, you don't know what that is, but there's a uniform component to the emission from FIRAS. FIRAS was the first instrument to be able to do this because it had a well-calibrated zero point. We just knew what zero power looked like. When you take that uniform part and take a look at it, you get a picture that looks like this. This is the galaxy spectrum, and there's the background spectrum. There are other ways of getting templates, spatial templates, to make this measurement. Here, then, is the FIRAS determination of the spectrum and two Derby points, and also points of some others. And a fit to this looks like a black body with an emissivity law. The question then is, what is this light? So there's a uniform component to a background. It looks like it's peaked somewhere at a terahertz, terahertz and a half. The question is, where does that come from? And part of it, at least, comes from sources like the ones that have been detected by SCUBA at 850 microns. SCUBA, in fact, has a luminosity function that looks something like this. And these are models of the total luminosity function. You can see that some reasonable fraction of the light is consistent with coming from these kinds of sources. What are those sources? Here is a map of the sources on the Hubble Deep Field. You can see that there's lots of galaxies that are not sources. The little white circles are, in fact, SCUBA sources. In some cases, they do not coincide with luminous galaxies. In other cases, they do. So it's a population, probably, of galaxies that are not always optically bright. Here's a characteristic spectrum of ultra-luminous infrared galaxies. And this is a compilation of a bunch of different spectra of dusty, very dusty, bright galaxies. Typically, what they have is a spectrum that is consistent with dust emission with temperatures on the order of 20, 30 degrees, and that peaks somewhere around a terahertz. The blue box is the range of frequencies that the EDGE experiment will measure. Now, one of the properties of these spectral characteristics is that if you have a spectral band here, this, by the way, is a spectrum of an unredshifted galaxy. If you have a spectral band here and you look at a redshifted galaxy, it moves the spectrum to the left, and so it makes the spectrum apparently brighter. It's a negative K correction, which happens in this entire submillimeter range of the spectrum. And this is one of the handles that we have on getting a distant estimator of fluctuation power. And that's one of the things that we're going to make use of. Here's a model of how that brightness of that spectrum varies with redshift from 0.1 to 10. And this is lots of little plots of the brightness as a function of redshift. And the bluest is a frequency at 12 terahertz, which is way in the wean side of that first plot. So as the redshift goes up, it just keeps getting dimmer. Not only is it dimmer because it's more distant, but it's also redshifting away from you. As you go further and further red, from blue to yellow into red, you can see there are actually times at the reddest of wavelengths where up to a redshift of 10, these objects would keep getting brighter as they redshifted into your band. Okay. So in order to estimate what kind of thing you would be looking at if you saw a whole bunch of these things, a simple model was made by Hyman and Knox, where they estimated what the dust parameters and characteristics of the underlying galaxies might be. And I'm not going to go through all of this except to say that the models include an estimate of the temperature of the dust, having to do with how much star formation there is and how much UV light there is to heat the dust, how much dust there is as a function of redshift, and that's sort of the integrated star formation. And that's then turned into a characteristic brightness or emissivity for galaxies as a function of redshift. So this is equivalent to the plots that the previous speakers have given you for the SE effect. This is a characteristic plot of how bright something would be as a function of wavelength, these two different wavelengths, which folds in this negative K correction. Okay, so those were the characteristics of the background as a whole. So what about the fluctuations? Points to be made are that the underlying matter fluctuation spectrum in the linear regime at very large scale is likely to be well understood because we have a handle at a redshift of 1,000 from the CMB, and the evolution of that into the redshift of 10 or 5 at the very largest scale is likely to be not hold many surprises. That should remain to be tested. The galaxy density responds to those fluctuations, matter fluctuations, but it's not known whether the brightness, in fact, it's likely that the brightness doesn't directly follow the matter density fluctuations, rather that there's a bias that comes on top of it, which is a complication, but also something that might make the fluctuations actually brighter. So the idea then is to give an independent handle on how galaxies form by testing to what degree the fluctuations continue to range over a range of redshifts. And these are tools for measuring the growth of structure models. So here we test whether this is actually true. We have the possibility of testing the relationship between density variations and galaxy formations as a function of Z if we can separate the fluctuations into a number of different ranges of Z. And in the end, although this will be a tricky one, we could see whether there is an epoch before which we don't see dusty galaxies at all. Again, this comes from the redshift determination that we can make. Okay, one question is why would one, so one of the elements of this measurement is that we are not counting galaxies. One way to do this would be to measure, make images of the sky like SCUBA does, count galaxies, calculate their correlation function, and find out what the structure is in the underlying galaxy density. The trouble with that is that the number of galaxies that you need is extremely high, and it's prohibitive, certainly with an instrument like SCUBA or even upcoming instruments, it's prohibitive to try to make a measurement of enough sky to be able to get the statistics to the point that you need to see the fluctuations. So the idea of this instrument is to avoid that by making a completely confusion-limited surface brightness measurement of the underlying infrared background. So instead of counting galaxies, we'll have a six arc minute beam. We have as many as 100 galaxies in there. We're not then sensitive. We don't have a magnitude limit. Rather, we take the integrated light over all of the galaxies in the luminosity function and measure the fluctuations of that from place to place. So if the idea is that if we knew all of the redshifts of 1,000 galaxies, we could make a 5% determination of the fluctuation power near an L of 800. If we if we only had color redshifts, we would need as many as 10 to the 5 galaxies in order to do a similar thing. And this experiment is one that gets at the large-scale structure without having to count individual galaxies. Now, there's counting galaxies and finding them and finding their redshift is a great thing, but for the large-scale structure, it's a complementary measurement. One of the issues is the fact that the dust from our own galaxy looks a lot in spectrum like the cosmic infrared background. In fact, it's one of the underlying things that made it so hard to detect. And this is from a paper by Knox et al., where a histogram was made of the dust variance as a function, basically this is a binning of the dust intensity as a function of the brightness of the dust fluctuations. So this is the mean dust fluctuations. The point is that there are a few bins that are very bright. This is a logarithm. I think it says that, yeah. Logarithm of the variance over the mean variance. So there are a few places that are very bright in dust variance, and there are many places that are really quite dim in dust variance. And so we believe there's a big enough piece of sky to be able to do this uncontaminated by dust. This is a model now of what we might expect to see in terms of a power spectrum at four different frequencies over the range of frequencies that the EDGE instrument would work. Let me just take one of them. Here is the cosmic infrared background power spectrum. The sensitivity of the EDGE measurement, which I'll tell you a little bit about the instrument in a minute, is something of this sort. And the expected dust contribution of the best 10% of the southern sky is at this level. The cosmic infrared background actually has two components to the fluctuations. One of them goes like L squared, 1 over L squared. That's just a shot noise component. So this is just having to do with the fact that the galaxies themselves are grainy in this picture. And so if we can measure the shot noise component, it gives us one number that has to do with the luminosity function. If we assume, for example, that it's a power law, then it gives us a scaling for the granularity or the brightness of galaxies. And that will change the characteristic tip here at the highest L. So at the very small, at the small L's, the shot noise dominates. At larger L's, the correlations due to the underlying mass fluctuations dominate the shot noise. And then this is the actual cosmological signal. At different frequencies, there are different factors that come in. At 210 gigahertz, the CMB anisotropy dominates. This is a slide to show that there are a number of tests and characteristics that we can look for in the fluctuation power. And in particular, suppose we stick with a given spatial angular size and ask where do the fluctuations come from at different frequencies. At the very highest frequency, the bluest light, where the redshifted galaxies shift out of our band, we're weighted to very low redshifts. Whereas at the longest wavelength, the galaxy fluctuations, the fluctuation power comes from higher redshifts because those are the galaxies that have shifted into the band. By making appropriate differences between channels, we should be able to make a separation between the fluctuations that are nearby and the fluctuations that are distant. Once we've done that, then, for example, at 270 gigahertz, the fluctuation power will come, the range of redshifts where it comes from is a function of size, simply due to the distance of the galaxies. This will all have to hang together, and if it does hang together, then I think it'll be good evidence that what we're seeing are actually the fluctuations that that come from the galaxy density fluctuations due to matter density fluctuations. Okay, so the experiment itself is a 10-day high-altitude balloon. We need the high-altitude balloon because we're going clear into the mid-infrared. I guess I misspoke. It's a 6 arc-minute resolution in 8 separate spectral bands ranging from a millimeter to 250 microns. The sky coverage is 400 square degrees. This is an example of what we might end up with. So here is a three fields stuck together of a SCUBA map of Blaine et al. And that is equivalent to a little area of this sort. The map that that Edge would make would be, this would be 100 square degrees. This is a simulation of the fluctuation spectrum that might result from that. And these are all the galaxies that would be in this bin. This is a picture of the payload. It's stabilized platform. It has a sun side, which has the solar panels on it, and a cold side. There are ground screens that aren't shown here. There are sun screens that aren't shown here. It's a 1 meter telescope. We don't need a big telescope because at higher frequencies we can get the resolution we need with a small telescope. It's about 1 meter, separately shielded, and there's a bunch of other cryogenics and the stuff you need to fly a balloon. One of the things is that I mentioned we have 8 bands, and the concept behind the bolometer detectors, they are multimode detectors. They use a frequency selective bolometer concept, which works in the following way. They are 2 layers of a dielectric membrane. The back layer is small metal crosses that are resonant at a given frequency and act as a back short. A quarter of a wavelength in front of that is another membrane that has resistive crosses. And by adjusting the parameters of these crosses and their resistance, you can control, given some incident radiation, the reflection, the transmission, and the absorption as a function of frequency. The goal then is that we can make a combination of characteristics that absorb radiation in a narrow band, reflect almost nowhere, and transmit all the radiation that's not absorbed. And from this, we can develop a tube which has a whole range of bolometers. These are 8 bolometers in a row, each one absorbing its own frequency, starting with the 1.5 terahertz band all the way down to the 270 gigahertz band. And the idea is then you can make, for example, here's a picture of a 7-pixel array with a cold optics. This is a 4 Kelvin beam-forming horn followed by an 8-band radiometer. So the 56 detectors sit in a thing that's 3 centimeters by 10 centimeters in size. This is a picture of how we get the redshift separation. This is the total picture of what the infrared background is. And these are the different galaxies at different redshifts have these different spectra. And so by linear combinations of the various bands we have, we should be able to make the separation in Z for given sets of fluctuations. This shows the piece of sky we'll cover. This is the boomerang area, and we'll take the cleanest section of a boomerang at the time. We fly in January, the sun is over here. That's the galactic plane and the south celestial pole. Okay, one thing to point out is that the just the map of the fluctuations in a number of different frequencies is not a probe that by itself will provide all the answers. In fact, this experiment will be highly enhanced by having other probes, in particular map or SCUBA kinds of measurements, or measurements of the spectra and the positions of point sources, will give us a handle on what the underlying population is that's causing the fluctuations. So submillimeter source counting experiments are extremely important for improving the strength of this experiment. Understanding what the galaxy bias and clustering is at low Z from SDSS is extremely important. Lyman alpha forest measurements are on the same spatial scale, completely different bias because that depends on the gas distribution, not the galaxy distribution. Be an interesting thing to compare with. And as Lloyd mentioned, if we had the underlying density fluctuations, we would have some measure here of the redshift dependence, and also then characteristic, we would be able to compare the density of galaxies to the actual matter density. We're currently in a two-year detector development phase. We hope in a year to be done with most of that work and start actually on the building of the instrument itself. The possible addition of a polarization-sensitive channel at these high frequencies would be interesting for the characterization of galactic dust, interesting for itself, and also potentially interesting for the measurement of CMB polarizations. We've got to understand that dust in order to be able to make sense of that. Okay, that's it.
Any questions?
We don't expect, I mean, there's point sources, so radio point sources we're not worried about. The dust point sources, the very nearby guys, contribute a very small amount of the fluctuation power. And presumably, if we had a map of the very bright, we would take account of them. But at the moment, we're not counting on having to subtract them because there are very few of them, very few such objects.
Lloyd would be disappointed with that. So you're purposely, I mean, because you're purposely making confusion with limited experiment, you're really relying on the models of what the galaxy, essentially the spectra, are like.
Right.
What are the uncertainties in that?
The uncertainties in the spectra?
Yeah, that you're getting used to do this redshift decomposition.
Lloyd
presented this sort of stuff years ago. That looked pretty nasty.
Yeah, there's the uncertainty in the spectrum will mostly give complication to the separation of redshift. I don't know how much that's going to affect it. I don't have a handle. I don't have a number on how much of a problem that's going to be. The initial goals that I think would be interesting are, first of all, to detect a component that looks like a shock noise component in this, because it would give you a very definite sense that the emission of the background itself is, in fact, the galaxies that are underlying this. It would give you a handle also on the luminosity function, but weighted not at the brightest couple of, I mean, right now, we are seeing the very brightest galaxies in the luminosity function. The rest of it is all gone, and this would be something that is weighted at the average brightness. It would give you the measure of the average brightness of the galaxies themselves. So that's one piece of it. Seeing the fluctuations correlation beyond that of the shock noise, so the actual correlating part, would be interesting in that it's then the beginnings of a handle on structure in an intermediate scale with a tracer that is not a tracer that we don't have this tracer in any other way. So it is not galaxy clusters, which are good tracers of density, but very remotely placed and weighted in some way. Galaxies are weighted in some other way.
Lyman alpha forest kinds of measures of structure are weighted in some third way. The nice thing about this is will be a broader picture of the kinds of things, the fluctuations that you might see, correlation between them, I think is the kind of handle that will allow us to actually look at some of the puzzles that are going to come with this.
So given that there are going to be these experiments really targeting the galaxies themselves, mm-hmm. I mean, they'll have substantial area. There are machines out there who do, get at these scooping galaxies. I mean, what will you add beyond?
Could
they get most of the way just doing, the counts of these galaxies?
There's two things that we can add. One is that we can add the area, just the plain surface brightness, the plain total solid angle that we can measure. Getting all the galaxies in that area is not something you're going to be able to do. I don't know whether 5,000 or 10,000 galaxies are in the cards in the next couple of years. I don't know that. The other thing is that all the machines that will do that will be all at 850 microns and longer. None of them will look at the shorter wavelengths. So that's what we can add. And I think the idea is we will add the correlation power at the largest angular scales on top of that which counting experiments went through.
Yeah, there is BLAST, of course.
There is BLAST.
Which I'm involved with.
Right. Right.
2D band. I think the place where Edge dominates is the large scale, because it's deliberately fusion.
Right.
So it's deliberately going after the large scale stuff. There's nobody that I know really competing there. The place where SCUBA fails is that it's too long a wavelength. So the far infrared background peaks at 200 microns or something. The SCUBA galaxies are at redshift 3, and the far infrared background galaxies are at redshift 1, some end wave thing. So SCUBA doesn't pick up most of those guys.
Right.
So the other thing that's just started is a SCUBA plus BLAST survey that the UK submillimeter community has started. So about, a quarter or a third of the UK telescope time in the next 2 years is being devoted to two quarter square degree fields, each of which will have a couple of hundred galaxies probably. And you can get a very good estimate of the two-point correlation function of the,
right.
of the SCUBA galaxies. But that doesn't tell you very much about the 200 micron galaxies and the larger scale fluctuations. So I think that's what Edge does.
The power spectrum at larger angular scales is something that won't come of that. You'll have a difference of perhaps two fields. You'll know something on that scale.
BLAST will do something that it's not designed to do,
right.
to do the larger angular scale. So it just depends on how you can make maps on tens of square degrees.
From my point of view, having a measure of the population, I mean, the combination of the surface brightness fluctuations as a function of frequency and the population from characteristic pieces is the pair of measurements that go together very well to try to characterize these fluctuations.
But like in the X-ray background, I mean, it's only when you can actually identify the things that are making up the background that you can actually go back and interpret. So
right.
It seems like this is sort of backwards. If this was what we had done a long time ago,
right.
then
I should say that this is a substantially easier experiment than any of these other ones. Fewer pixels, lower pointing requirements, simpler radiometer, any number of things, tiny telescope, da 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 da. So in some sense, it's for free almost compared to really an extensive measurement of the brightness.
Well, life is easy.
Life is easy, yeah.
What's your take on usefulness to this program? 360
micron
surveys and the power spectral analysis that we carried out.
I haven't thought about it.
Because that's going to happen very soon.
I think the problem is going to be the solid angle, the total solid angle measured, but I haven't thought about it. Mm-hmm.